But Pranayaparamita isn't like that. Pranayaparamita is a mature woman. She's in her prime, much more in a Miss Jean Brodie sort of way than a teenage kind of way. She's still a very, very beautiful woman. Yeah. Vasantra makes the observation that wisdom takes time to ripen. Time to mature. And she has the adornments of a bodhisattva. So a bodhisattva, for those of you who are new to all of this stuff, is a Buddhist figure, a being who is a kind of an archetypal incarnation of an aspect of enlightenment. And they are, because they're so full of extraordinary qualities, they're often depicted as princes and princesses. They're usually sort of resplendent in glory, as it were, which I think is to pinch a phrase from evangelical Christianity, but there we go. So I brought this particular figure in with me, just because it's quite a nice big... It's one of my rupas. I don't quite know who it is, actually, but... If it wasn't a bloke, it would be Pranayaparamita. But it's a bloke, so it's not. But it does show you that the crown, Pranayaparamita, like all bodhisattvas, has a crown or a coronet. And it has the five jewels. It has five jewels in it: a white jewel, a red jewel, a blue jewel, a green jewel, and a yellow jewel. And these jewels represent the wisdoms of the five Buddhas, the Buddhas of the mandala. I'm going to put this over here because it's rather heavy and it's going to make the lectern fall over if I don't. Silks, flowing robes, golden anklets and... Anklets? Wrist, you know, bracelets, anklets. All sorts of things that have a whole bunch of correlations with the paramitas and qualities of the Buddha and Bodhisattva. But just, in a way, what it's communicating is... abundance. It's not a bling bling kind of thing. Well, it is a bling bling. In a way, bling bling is a bad way of trying to imitate genuine abundance. Yeah? Does that make sense to people? Yeah, so it's kind of like the whole kind of Essex gold chain thing is an attempt to sort of say, well, I'm very abundant, but in quite a rather unsuccessful and unconvincing way, really. Or at least in a way that makes us... In a way, it's a bit unfortunate, because it kind of... it makes us a bit... suspicious of genuine abundance, as it were. Genuine sort of wealth in a kind of... in a pure sense. We tend to see it as ostentation and wealth as being something rather gaudy and untacky, don't we? But meanwhile, back at Pranayaparamita. Perhaps the most extraordinary thing about Pranayaparamita, the thing that I think is unique to her as a Buddhist figure, is that this beautiful golden body that she has, if you get up close to it, in the same way that a printed image or a projected image is made up of lots of little dots, yeah? Pranayaparamita is made up of lots and lots and lots of little golden Buddhas. She's a being whose entire existence, as it were, her entire being is of Buddhas. She exists entirely. She's entirely made of golden Buddhas. So it's as though, from a distance, you've got this beautiful woman, this goddess, this wisdom goddess. And as you get up close, you see that it's all of the Buddhas, as it were. You know, she is all of the Buddhas. She's not just the mother of the Buddhas in a way. She is all the Buddhas. And she has an unusually wide range of attributes and gestures. The Tibetans had already, as Vasantra puts it, Tibetans had already fallen in love with Tara, so they didn't really have much room for another female, another goddess in their pantheon. So Pranayaparamita seems to have been extraordinarily popular. Main popularity seems to have been in India, but she's sort of the Far East. She's quite popular as well. But of course, with the Islamic hordes coming in and sort of destroying the temples, burning the libraries, smashing all the statues, relatively few Pranayaparamita images survive. until quite recently, actually. I think she's touched something in the Western psyche that she didn't quite get to in the Eastern psyche after the sort of the 13th century. Is that when the Mongol hordes came in? 13th, 14th century, somewhere around there. I could say that. None of you are sufficiently familiar with the Indian. You're the Indian history expert. Is it a bit early for you? Too history. Okay. So there are a lot of different forms, but the most usual form that we'll find, and the reason I brought in the statue, is the usual form is a four-armed figure. And the usual, and again, the reason I brought this in is because the main two arms are in this slightly mysterious gesture. This gesture is called the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the gesture, the Dharma Chakra Pravartana Mudra. And I'll come back to that, actually, because it's one of my little specialist subjects, because I didn't understand it for a long time, so I did quite a lot of homework about it. So I'll come back to the Dharma Chakra Pravartana. And then she has another couple of arms. Quite often, it's not shown in any of the images we've got here, but quite often she holds a lotus in those two arms, and these lotuses curl up, and the other things that she has are on top of the lotuses. It's almost, she's always got a book. Yeah, she's always got the perfection of wisdom, because she is the perfection of wisdom. It is, she and the book are the same in a way. She sometimes has the flaming sword of Manjushri, who is the male bodhisattva of wisdom, this sort of sword that cuts through illusion. I tend to think of it, you get these stories, don't you, about being able to drop a silk onto a sword and it just fall perfectly in two. You know, it's that sort of sword. And I tend to think of it as a cross between that and a sort of an epée, you know. It's an extremely fine, precise point. It's definitely not a double-handed broadsword, you know. It's not the sort of sword that wisdom is. Sometimes she has a mala, which is a kind of Buddhist rosary. It's the thing that you count mantras on. What Vasantra says about this is that this emphasizes the need for repetition. We need to come back to things. We're used to lots of new stimulus. We get bored really easy. And we want new things every week. We want new information about Buddhism. Rather than taking the things we know about Buddhism deeper and deeper, what we want is more information about Buddhism. We want more, pseudo-spiritual entertainment in a way. But there's a need, if you want to get to the depths, you can't sort of bounce off the surface like that and go for new things. You need to keep going back to the same stuff and going deeper and deeper with it. In the very long Perfection of Wisdom text, so there's a Perfection of Wisdom in 100,000 words, apparently 80% of that is repetition, which sounds really boring, doesn't it? So you've got a Perfection of Wisdom text and then you've got it another four times. So, but in a way what we do is we just, in a way what's great about the Heart Sutra is there we've got this quite concise teaching and we can keep coming back to it, and what we're going to be doing through this whole session in a way is trying to take ourselves deeper and deeper into that one text, aren't we? So that's our way into repetition. She sometimes has the begging bowl of the mendicant, the sort of wandering monk or nun, which is a sign of spiritual practice. The lotuses, of course, symbols of unfoldment, development, sensitivity and receptivity, but also of that whole business of sort of development, fulfilling one's potential. So the Dharma Chakra Pravartana Mudra, the turning the wheel of the Dharma. This is one of those gestures. It's a very stylized thing. It's not the sort of thing, you know, you don't go around during the day doing this very often. At least most people don't. And it's related to the Buddha's first teaching. So after the Buddha's enlightenment, after the Buddha got enlightened, as many of you will know, to start off with, he spent quite a lot of time, he spent about 7 weeks assimilating the experience, sort of working, you know, just kind of absorbing it all. And during that phase, one of the sort of thought processes, as it seems to have gone through, is how on earth am I going to communicate this to anybody in a way that they can make sense of? Because it's such a subtle thing, as we already explored last week, in a way. If the nature of existence is beyond conceptualizations, how on earth do you communicate with people in a way which is going to help them to move beyond conceptualization? How on earth do you try and get that across? But he realized that, you know, people were going to make, there were people around who'd make some progress. And there's some great stories about how that came about. And he went and found a bunch of guys that he used to practice with. Although they'd sort of deserted him when he'd taken a different path, he still was appreciative of the support they'd given him on his quest. And he felt a connection with them. He knew that they were genuine spiritual aspirants. And he tracked them down, wandering through northern India in the height of summer. Across this huge flat area. And kind of went into retreat with them. And it's sometimes talked about as the Buddha's first sermon, or his first teaching, as though as he was walking towards them, he'd sort of say, well, when I've got there, I'm going to tell them this, 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 and this. You know, I don't believe that's how it was. I think it was much more. These were his friends. He'd been, you know, working and practicing with them for 5-6 years. Yeah. So what he did was he came and he found his friends. And just how he was, this is another example of this whole darshan thing, actually, is when they saw him in the distance, they thought, oh, look, there's Gotama coming. There's that guy who went off and was that spiritual slacker who sort of, you know, we won't give him any respect when he comes up. But when he came up, he was, his enlightened consciousness, his state of mind, as it were, although the phrase state of mind presumably doesn't go anywhere near an enlightened consciousness, had such a dramatic effect on them that his just how he was, they couldn't help themselves but to make him welcome and make it, you know, and treat him with respect and be kind and friendly to him. So he just engaged in communication with them as much as he possibly could. And through that, there was a breakthrough. The first enlightened person after the Buddha was called Kandanya, who became known as Kandanya who knows. So you get this sort of joke in Buddhism about Kandanya's nose quite a lot. Buddhist jokes tend to be rather bad, I'm afraid. We haven't got much material. Never go and see a Buddhist stand-up comedian.